I understand that some of you may have had some difficulty. Oops, is this on?
Yes.
It's on.
Have a little light?
Nope. Thank you. I understand some of you may have had some difficulty hearing us.
It's off. Yell.
Yeah, well, we apologize for the sound, and we'll try to speak up. I just would mention to the lawyers in the next case that they could do so, and we'll try to do the same here. Let me ask the lawyers for the next case to introduce themselves, and then I'll ask Mr. Petty for the appellant to give an overview of the facts concerning his case, and then respondent can, Mr. Plager can clarify or correct if he chooses to do so, and then we'll get started with the argument. So, Mr. Petty, would you introduce yourself and give the students a little bit about your background?
All right, thank you. My name is John Petty. I am a chief deputy with the Washoe County Public Defender's Office, and I am their appellate deputy. I've been writing appeals for the Public Defender's Office since 1994, so that's about 23 years. A couple of years before that, I was a trial attorney, and between the time that I was a trial attorney and became an appellate writer, I spent 5 years at the district court as a court master, so I had a little bit of experience from the court end as well. I grew up here in Sparks. I was born in Hawthorne, but I grew up in Sparks, went to Robert Mitchell Elementary School down in Prater Way. I went to Dilworth Junior High School and ultimately Sparks High School. From Sparks High School, I went to the University of Nevada, where I got a degree in anthropology. And because anthropology is such a lucrative profession, I studied it a lot. But there actually is a connection, because one of the interests in anthropology is rules and why society follows the rules. And law is our constitutes our rules society. So I went to law school. From law school, I found out that I really enjoyed the study of law, and I found out later that I enjoyed the practice of law. And that's a little bit about my background, and then I'll talk about the future.
Thank you. Brian?
Thank you, Mr. Parsky. My name is Joe Fader. I work for the Washington County District Attorney's Office. I live in Reno. I'm born and raised in Reno. Fortunately, I went to Reno High School before that. My wife is a practicing lawyer at the DA's office as well. We have four children. After Reno High School, I went to BYU, graduated in philosophy, went to BYU Law School, and I've been with the DA's office since 1998.
Okay. Mr. Petty?
Thank you, Mr.
We won't start your time just yet. Give them an overview of the facts.
All right, then I won't speak fast.
maybe use the microphone if you could, John, if you don't mind.
All right. Can you all hear me? Okay, I'm just going to give you the facts briefly. This case involves a young man by the name of Paul Revelle, who in 2009 left high school, didn't complete high school, and he and his girlfriend moved to Reno into a motel. By April of 2010, they gave birth to a child, a young boy named Skye, who had some medical issues such that he at least went back to renowned medical on a couple of emergency admissions shortly after birth. He was born in April. He went back first in May and then later went back in June. He was treated and discharged, but our case here begins in September of 2010, when my client, Paul Revelle, called down to the office manager of the hotel that he was staying at, asking for assistance because his child had stopped breathing. Medics arrived, they found the child, attempted to resuscitate the child, began life-saving efforts, ultimately took the child to renowned medical, where that child died about 3 days later. He was pronounced brain dead. Organs were harvested, and then the child was about to die. That was in September of 2009. The police talked to my client, they talked to the mother, they talked to other people, but it wasn't until June of 2010 when the medical examiner finally signed off on a certificate of death, finding that it was non-accidental injury. In the old days, that would have been called shaken baby syndrome, but they don't use that term any longer because the term shaken baby implies the cause. So now they use non-accidental trauma. That certificate was issued in June of 2011. An arrest warrant went out, and my client, who was living in Reno at a hotel, was arrested in December of 2009 and was prosecuted for first-degree murder. The state's theory, obviously, was non-accidental head trauma causing death. The defense put on a case with experts suggesting that it was natural causes. There were some medical conditions that the baby had, tumors in the heart and the brain, some other conditions that could lead to apnea, which could lead to anoxasia, which is swelling of the brain, and ultimately brain death. That information was shared with the prosecution, who, at the behest of one of their experts, suggested that the state should contact a genetic testing laboratory to get some test results. And to make a long story short, they did. Those results came back, and the question that was presented was, how were they going to be admitted? The district court judge allowed a representative of that laboratory to testify as to the test results over objection. The defense wanted to be able to cross-examine those people necessary to show how the tests were done, how they were performed, and how the results were reached. And that really is the issue that we have today. Because our contention is that the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution guarantees a criminal defendant the right to confront the witnesses against him. And the witnesses against him, in this case, were many of those lab techs that were not called upon to testify at court. We believe that violates the Sixth Amendment, and we're here today to ask the court to agree with us, and if they do, we're asking for a new trial.
Mr. Prater, would you like to... Nothing to add? Okay, Mr. Petty, go ahead, sir.
Mr. Prater's not usually that agreeable with me, so... The Appeals Court, John Petty on behalf of Paul Revelle, the appellant in this action, we're going to try and reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, and I'll watch my clock, I'll watch my time. As indicated, this case presents this court with a question of constitutional law, the Sixth Amendment, the right to confront witnesses against a criminal defendant. There are three United States Supreme Court cases that basically dictate the result in this case. The first is Crawford v. Washington, which was decided in 2004. And then immediately behind that, a case called Melendez-Diaz in Massachusetts. And then, of course, the final case, Bullcoming v. New Mexico. What those cases stand for collectively, essentially, is this. Crawford says that the Sixth Amendment requires that a defendant be confronted by witnesses against him. Those witnesses can testify in court, but if that witness is unavailable for some reason, then the only way that testimonial hearsay is what it's characterized as can be admitted as substantive evidence in trial is if the defendant had a prior opportunity to conduct cross-examination. I mean, we can all agree that in this situation there was never a prior opportunity for Mr. Bell or his counsel to cross-examine the lab technicians and other analysts at this company called Transgenomic.
Now, isn't it, if you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but the lab technicians, there were approximately 17 to 20 that were involved in the testing process?
That's my understanding of the record, yes.
And then there was one particular expert that did testify and indicated that she had reviewed everything that pertained to the testing, and she was ultimately responsible for signing off.
That's her testimony, yes.
Yeah.
And the problem with that is this. That testifying person was not a medical doctor, was not a scientific doctor. She received her PhD in genetics. She was a consulting expert for that particular laboratory and had been with that laboratory over a number of years as it had gone through various iterations because it had been bought and sold. So she was a consultant. She testified that she did not conduct any of the lab examinations herself. She wasn't even in the lab when they were being conducted. All she did was she received a report. She read through it to see if it met some standards and signed off on that. The other report that she signed off on, she didn't even initially do that, sign off on that report in the beginning. That second report was signed off by a second consultant, but then she added some population studies that she testified didn't really affect the substance of the report, and then she was allowed to make comment and testify about both of those reports in court.
Okay, and you're also asserting that that violated Crawford.
Yes, that violates Crawford, and the fact that the lab technicians did were not called to testify.
Now, let me ask you this. The other thing that struck me as I was reading through this was that when the genetic testing was requested and all of that went back to the lab, there was no reason given for them to test. And so how do you determine that that's testimonial under Crawford?
I'll circle back to some of the predicate of this question, but to get to that last point, that's essentially what Judge Palaha determined. He said that this testimony was going to be non-testimonial, relying on a plurality opinion by the Supreme Court called Williams v. Illinois. We believe that Justice Kagan's dissent in that particular opinion is the better statement of the actual applicable law, and if you were to follow Justice Kagan's dissent analysis in that case, you could not affirm Judge Palaha's order, and you could not find that this evidence was testimonial. It is testimonial evidence.
And what
the fact that the people who tested this information allegedly didn't, and we don't know that. We just have Dr. Murphy's comment on that. Didn't know that it was being tested for a criminal case. Doesn't mean that they're non-accusatory witnesses. The test isn't, do they know, are they non-accusatory? Those tests don't exist. Justice Kagan said where they came from, it's anybody's guess, but they don't apply. The question for testimonial evidence, standard that this court has to apply, is this. Is that forensic report being developed to establish some fact to be used in a criminal case? And in this case, it was. Those forensic reports were being used to develop a fact, and that fact was that it rebutted the expert testimony, it was being offered to rebut the expert testimony of the defense with regards to natural cause bases for Skye's death, as opposed to the notion offered by Dr. Amalu and Dr. Kubitschek that it was a non-accidental injury. So the test is it being used to develop a fact? And it was. It doesn't matter a whit that the actual technicians didn't know that there was a criminal case pending in Reno, Nevada. That is not the test. And to the extent that Williams would and Justice Alito's opinion would suggest that to this court, I would recommend that you read Justice Kagan's dissent and you go back and look at Melendez-Diaz, because Justice Scalia rejects that notion as well in Melendez-Diaz. So I want to go back and say that.
So what test should this court consider, since your position is that whether something is testimonial is certainly in flux or appears to be in dispute in the Williams versus Illinois case? What test should we adopt? We have talked about testimonial evidence before in other contexts.
The Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, talked about a primary purpose test in Davis v. Washington. That was in the context of trying to distinguish statements that were being made for the purpose of asserting some kind of criminality versus those that were being made in an emergency situation to elicit some kind of emergency response. But that primary purpose test, even though it's in a different context, percolates up in some of the decisions. So you'll see it in Volkoming, you'll see it in Williams v. Illinois. I think the test is what I just said. Is the purpose of the report, the forensic report, to develop a fact to be used in a criminal prosecution? And if it is, then it is testimonial. And if it's testimonial, the only way that it can be admitted is if the people who created that document, the text and the analysis, are there to testify, or
the defendant had had a prior opportunity to conduct cross-examination, neither of which occurred in this case, which is why we're asking this court to reverse this conviction and send it back for a new trial with that purpose. Justice Scalia in Crawford and Melendez-Diaz, and as echoed by Justice Kagan and Williams in her dissent, made it clear that the Confrontation Clause is placing a burden on the state to prove their charge, and they can make an election as to who they want to call to prove those charges up. It does not shift under some kind of adjunct to the compulsory process charge, but the state can say, we're going to do this, and if you want to cross-examine them, well, then you just subpoena them and bring them in yourself. It is the state's burden, not the defendant's. And because it is the state's burden, and because the Confrontation Clause says the best way to decide, well, the Confrontation Clause says the way that we constitutionally determine whether or not that evidence is reliable is through the crucible of cross-examination.
So assuming that we agreed with your position about how testimonial evidence should be defined, what would warrant a new trial here? Why wouldn't we view this as harmless?
It's not harmless, and it's not harmless for, I think, three reasons. The first is there was a significant disagreement with regards to cause of death, Sky's cause of death. The state's experts, Dr. Malu and Dr. Kubitschek, all suggested non-accidental brain injury.
Can you speak up, Mr. Petty?
I'm sorry. I thought I was doing a pretty good job. There was a significant disagreement between the state and the prosecution and the defense theory of cause of death. The state's theory was non-accidental head trauma, but the defense offered up several qualified experts who testified that with regards to his death, it could have been caused by edema and anoxasia, which is swelling of the brain, that this may have been caused by tumors that existed in the heart and in the brain. There were a variety of medical suggestions with regards to why this death was natural and was not a homicide. And if it was a natural death, Mr. O'Brien would never have faced prosecution. That's number one. Number two, with regards to the dispute between the genetic lab and the testimony offered by the defense experts, Dr. Amali was allowed to not only vouch for the credibility of those genetic tests, but in so doing was allowed to disparage the defense theory. He called the defense theory esoteric and exotic and far-fetched and a few other adjectives that I didn't write down. But primarily, the reason why it's not harmless error is because the Confrontation Clause guarantees the right of cross-examination. Those experts should have been cross-examination with regards to their expertise, their training, past mistakes, potential contamination, were the right samples used, were the right procedures followed. There's a variety of questions that this court knows from their collective practice that you can ask expert witnesses in order to develop and or attack the results that they are offering to the court by way of testimony. This case, at first glance, you might say, well, it kind of looks like the evidence is pretty sufficient, even without those tests. But I suggest to you, to this court, that is not the case, that because of the significant disagreement between the parties, this case should go back for a new trial, and Mr. Revelle should be given the opportunity to cross-examine those testimonial witnesses who are going to present hearsay against him by the state. And that was written out 3 minutes ago.
Okay. Mr. Blair?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Joe Plater. I represent the state of Nevada on behalf of the District Attorney's Office in Reno. So today we think the court has the opportunity to define what a witness against the accused means under the Confrontation Clause. And we think the court should adopt the definition or the reasoning of the United States Supreme Court in Williams versus Illinois to define that phrase. At the outset, I think perhaps the most dispositive issue in the case is harmless error. We'll get to the confrontation issue in a second, but even if the court found there was error in permitting Dr. Murphy to testify about the DNA results of her lab's testing, that error would be harmless, and here's the reason. Now, Mr. Petty argues that there was a dispute among the parties as to the cause of death, because they did present some evidence of alternative causation. There was some evidence presented by defense experts that perhaps this little boy died of edema, heart tumors. There was something called tuberous sclerosis complex. And indeed, these were pretty bizarre or exotic types of diseases. But there was no dispute, and there was no evidence supporting or contradicting what Dr. Murphy testified to at trial. She was presented only to tell the jury that there was no specific genetic heart diseases in this baby. And the heart diseases were labeled channelopathy and cardiomyopathy. And her genetics lab ran the tests, and she said, our lab found none of these cardiac diseases in this young boy. And there was no dispute about that at trial. No other defense expert came forward and said, we don't agree with that. There was no other evidence presented that Skye, this young boy, died from any type of heart disease that had some type of a genetic basis. So even if her testimony was admitted in error, we think the judgment of conviction should be affirmed because it was harmless. In other words, Revelle never based his defense on this case at trial on the idea that the boy died from any genetic heart disease. He never argued that because there's no evidence to support it. In fact, one of the defense experts, their own expert, Dr. Burke, agreed with Dr. Murphy that he saw no signs of channelopathy or cardiomyopathy.
Now let me ask you this, I just want to make sure I understand. Dr. Murphy didn't testify regarding any aspects of the tuberous sclerosis, the TSC, is that correct?
Right, she didn't, as I recall. And, she wasn't hired to do that.
And my understanding is the none of the defense experts testified as to cardiomyopathy or any of the other heart conditions.
Correct.
And so you're saying no harm, no foul, because you only had Dr. Murphy testify to genetic factors pertaining to those two diseases.
Well, let me modify my answer, Justice Caligari. Okay. There was a defense expert who addressed cardiomyopathy and channelopathy, but he supported Dr. Murphy. He said, I see no evidence of that.
That it's unusual in him.
Because it's pretty unusual to find that in a young boy,
yeah,
or anyone of that age. Dr. Murphy testified that she had seen that. This might have been a pretrial hearing. She had seen these types of diseases in young children that were 4 or 5 years old, but she had never seen a case in an infant. And Dr. Burke, the defense expert, agreed. So there was a defense expert who addressed it, but he was in line with Dr. Murphy. There was one other expert, defense expert, who said, well, there's some possibilities of some genetic diseases going on with this young boy's heart, but he conceded it was, he said it was complete speculation on my part. This is out of my arena, I just don't know. So you're right. There were two experts who addressed it and they agreed that there was no evidence of any genetic heart disease in this young boy.
And that's why you're asserting it's harmless, even if it was errored.
Right. Right. And we think that's the dispositive issue in this case, for sure. But we also think that there was no confrontation violation because in Williams versus Illinois, the plurality of the court adopted a definition of what constitutes a statement under the Confrontation Clause as being something that has the primary purpose of accusing a targeted individual of a crime. And in this case, we don't see any type of statement that meets that test.
Mr. Plater, then would that suggest that the defense only has the opportunity to cross-examine witnesses, the ones that fit into that category? It seems to me Williams is not really the case, the lens to view this, first of all, plurality.
Right.
It dealt with a different issue. It dealt with experts relying upon possibly inadmissible evidence. We have two cases that are almost directly on point, Melendez-Diaz and Bullcoming. Do you feel that just if you look through those lenses of Melendez-Diaz and not the plurality, not Williams, and Bullcoming, do you think that the district court came to the right conclusion?
I do, Justice Stiglitz, and here's why. Because even though we have the plurality giving their definition of what constitutes testimonial hearsay, we also have Justice Thomas, who gave his own version of what constitutes testimonial hearsay. And basically he says it's a formalized statement that has indicia of solemnity, meaning it has to be sworn or a sworn or certified declaration of fact. And he also said it had to be a statement that was developed for the purposes of a criminal trial. So we believe that if you look at the plurality and with Justice Thomas's concurring opinion, we now have five justices on the United States Supreme Court who view DNA reports or testing in a case like Williams to be beyond the reach of a confrontation clause violation. So you can use either one of their tests, but both of those tests would mean that in this case, this DNA report or the testimony of Dr. Murphy, it didn't violate the confrontation clause, because when she developed her test or when she testified about the results, frankly, the test was never requested for a criminal purpose. In fact, it could have exonerated Mr. Revelle, just like the DNA test in Williams. When Cellmark was hired to do, it was an outside lab, to do a DNA profile of the defendant, it had absolutely no idea why it was doing it. And the court said, in fact, maybe the result of that test could have exonerated the defendant. The same is true here. When Dr. Murphy's firm was hired, she testified she had no idea why the test was hired. She didn't find out this was a homicide case until after the results of the test were completed and sent to the medical examiner's office here in Reno. So there was no prosecutorial purpose that was behind the hiring of Dr. Murphy or the development of a DNA profile in the test that she gave us. It was not a formalized statement. No one testified under oath or gave a sworn statement as to the contents. So we think that there are now at least five people on the United States Supreme Court who would view a report like this to be beyond the reach of the Confrontation Clause. But you also have to consider what Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan, who joined Sotomayor, and Sotomayor's dissent in Bullcoming. Because there they said, look, we would have a different situation if we had the actual lab director or the reviewer who came in from the lab and who could verify lab procedures and the test results. Someone that had a specific connection or some type of personal, although limited connection to the test that was done in that lab. And so they seem to imply if you have a lab director, somebody who knows what's going on in the lab and who can verify the lab results and the lab procedures, that might be beyond the scope of the Confrontation Clause. So we think maybe there are even seven justices on the United States Supreme Court who would support Judge Plaza's decision.
Well, Melendez-Diaz in Bullcoming seemed to suggest that the certifier of the report is sufficient.
Right.
Are you suggesting that in this instance, if the same genetic testing had been done at the Washoe County Crime Lab, that then the Confrontation Clause would be implicated, but because it was done at a private lab, it's not implicated?
It depends. It depends what the knowledge is of the people who are performing the testing, and why the test was requested. I can't answer that without more specific factual context. So, for example, if the medical examiner, Dr. Kubitschek, just wanted to find out if there was some type of alternative causation, if he's unsure why the young boy dies, and he wants to order a specific independent separate test through our Washoe County lab, that may actually exculpate the defendant, then I think that doesn't necessarily implicate confrontation issues, because it's not a test, as the plurality said in Williams, that's designed to target a specific individual of a crime. And it doesn't meet Justice Thomas's test either. It's not being sought for necessarily in a prosecutorial setting. or to prosecute a crime.
In that regard, let me ask you this. It was the prosecutor's office that requested the genetic testing after you learned what the theory of defense was. Is that correct or incorrect?
I don't recall exactly. I know the medical examiner, to be specific, the medical examiner's office in this case requested transgenomic, Dr. Murphy, to do the testing. I don't recall if Dr. Kubitschek made that request because of what the prosecutor wanted done. That may or may not have been the case. But I think the important thing to remember is what Dr. Murphy thought she was doing. It can't be necessarily the intent of the prosecutor's office in requesting the test that determines whether the statement's going to fall under the auspices of the Confrontation Clause. Just like in the Williams case, the court noted that Selmark had absolutely no idea why it was doing the testing. It was just asked to do that. And it could have been exculpatory, for all we know, for the defendant. But going back, Justice Stiglitz, to Melendez-Diaz and Bullcoming, you have to remember that what happened in most cases is that the actual reports were admitted themselves. That didn't happen in Williams, and it didn't happen in this case. And the reports that were admitted in Melendez-Diaz were certificates that were notarized or that were executed before a notary, testifying or certifying that the substance that the defendant had was cocaine. Now, that was obviously for a prosecutorial purpose, and because that type of testing goes to an essential element that the defendant of the crime the defendant is charged with. And so to admit the certificate in lieu of a live witness who actually interpreted the testing, we don't have any problem that violates the Confrontation Clause. And neither did the plurality in Williams. They said, look, our analysis is completely consistent with Bullcoming and Melendez-Diaz. In Bullcoming, as you know, there were certificates. Well, there was an analyst who testified to another analyst's finding regarding the blood alcohol test. And that met the plurality test in Williams because it was obviously for prosecutorial purpose. It was developed against a specific targeted individual. It was a formalized document. And so the plurality in Williams had no problem with distinguishing Melendez-Diaz and Bullcoming from the instant case that they had in front of them there.
Mr. Plater, I'd like to clarify the record. Maybe I'm misunderstanding here, but I thought that one of the defense experts, Burke or another one, specifically raised the possibility that tuberous sclerosis would be a cause of this child's death, a process in which, since birth, the brain would continue to expand to the point where there would be a deprivation of oxygen and the like. I thought the point in getting the genetic testing was to show that the body of this child was not susceptible to that disease condition. Now, if those are the facts, isn't there a contradiction in what was a cause or a potential cause of this death? Wasn't that the point of the testimony to rule out as a genetic disease that genetically this child does not have tuberous sclerosis?
My understanding.
Wasn't that why the pathologist sought out transgenomic?
Dr. Murphy was hired to determine whether there was any type of myopathy in the child's heart. She referred to it as channel myopathy or cardiomyopathy.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding, just as hard as Steve, is that this tuberous sclerosis was not part of that complex of syndromes that she was testing for. Now, I might be wrong about that. I don't know. Because my understanding is that had nothing to do with what she was testing for. Channelopathy and cardiomyopathy didn't necessarily, what she was testing for wasn't supposed to include this tuberous sclerosis complex.
Okay.
Although now Dr. Burke did, as you say, he testified that he saw some evidence of tuberous sclerosis, The other defense expert disagreed with that, and that was their own expert. So, in summary, we would ask the court to follow the plurality's reasoning in Williams v. Illinois. If you don't like that reasoning, then add on Justice Thomas's definition of what constitutes testimonial hearsay. But under either test, you're not going to find that there was a violation of the Confrontation Clause in this case. And by the way, this isn't to denigrate Crawford at all. We agree that Crawford's good law, but the only thing that happened in Crawford, well, it was a big thing that happened in Crawford, but Justice Scalia said, what we're going to do is we're going to find that witnesses are going to be defined as those who bear testimony. And so testimonial hearsay is what the Confrontation Clause addresses. He said, we'll leave for another day the an exhaustive definition of what constitutes testimonial hearsay. But for now, we know there's a core. Oh, am I over? I'm really over.
You're out of time. You're out of time.
Okay. We'd ask you then to affirm the judgment of conviction.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Plater. Mr. Petty, could you clarify the factual issue I raised?
I will. Your understanding of the facts is correct, and that also ties into Justice Berger's question about timing. The defense offered their expert witness conclusions to the prosecution, and in response to that, the prosecution then, at the suggestion of Dr. Amalu, contacted Transgenomics for the purpose of conducting these genetic tests. But Dr. Berger, his testimony was consistent with what you recounted. And in addition, I believe it was Dr. Burke who said, these genetic tests are testing for the wrong thing. So they're not even reliable on that score. And that's the basis for cross-examination that should have been done with the analyst.
But that was, you set forth three theories, from what I understand, two heart-related and then the brain issue. And that my understanding after reviewing this was that the test Dr. Murphy testified to related solely to the heart.
My understanding is, with regards to the genetic testing that was done, was to show the presence of this condition like sclerosis, tuberous sclerosis, and another heart murmur, a different heart tumor that was present, because they manifest themselves not only in the heart, but the lung and the brain. And the theory that the defense had was that this child's brain size, raised brain swelling, and the hematomas that were found in the brain were largely products of natural causes, which caused the swelling in the brain, which led to oxygen deprivation, which led to death. So that's the dispute between the state's theory defense, or the state's experts and the defense experts. But before I run out of time, Mr. Plater asked this court to follow the plurality of Williams. You shouldn't. It's not controlling law. And you shouldn't. The suggestion that Justice Thomas added a fifth vote so it's good is completely wrong. If you do just a cursory review of the cases that came out after Williams v. Illinois, and I have one right here, it was decided in 2016 out of Pennsylvania. It's 139 Atlantic 3rd 208. And particularly the Penn site, I've lost it. The court points out that in Williams, a splintered United States Supreme Court held that a DNA report used to compare with a known suspect's DNA profile was non-testimonial. In his opinion, Justice Alito stated that the forensic report at issue in Williams was non-testimonial because it did not target a specific individual. Five justices, however, rejected Justice Alito's rationale and instead found that the forensic report need not accuse a particular individual in order to be testimonial in nature. And that's the test that I'm talking about. We're talking about testimonial hearsay. Hearsay is a statement. It can be a written statement, it can be a report, it can be an oral statement. Dr. Murphy came to Washoe County to testify as a surrogate for these lab techs back in Connecticut. Harold Cummings says that that's wrong, Crawford says that that's wrong, Williams Diaz says that that's wrong, and the plurality opinion in Williams doesn't change that one iota, and I thank you for the court's attention.
All right, again, I'm still, if I may, Chief,
mm-hmm.
I'm still concerned about the issue of Dr. Murphy doing genetic testing for all three conditions. My understanding it was for two. If you could provide the citation to the record.
Well, my understanding is to support that. My understanding of the record is that they did conduct genetic testing with channelopathy and cardiomyopathy, testing for genetic basis to see if there's a basis, the genetic mutation basis for tuberous sclerosis and some of the other conditions that were met. So they were testing for those two features, the myopathies, as they relate to the other conditions. That's what they were doing.
And that's what she testified to.
Right, and she did not testify as to tuberous sclerosis.
Correct.
That was a different expert from...
So, and again, that brings us back to the harmless error analysis, if there was, in fact, an error.
I understand the reason to that that's an issue, but I ask that you not find it harmless in this case.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Petty. Mr. Planer, Mr. Petty, thank you very much. I think they did an outstanding job. I know that you probably have to get back to classes or, pardon me? Their lunch, okay, that's important, big deal. Let me just conclude by this. First of all, I want to tell you that we really appreciate the opportunity to be at Reed High School. It means a lot to us, and it means a lot to me personally. Reed High School is very close to my heart. My two daughters went to high school here, and my three grandchildren, Darby and Keely Grove, go to school here. Stand up, girls. I also want to tell you how impressed I was. I had the privilege of attending the performances or the presentations made by We the People in competition at regionals, and I just can't begin to tell you how impressed I was with Reed High School's performance in We the People. You won two units in regionals. You should be very proud of that, and I think your entire team was really terrific. Very proud of what you guys accomplished there. I wish we had more time for questions, but we probably ought to get you off to lunch. I'm grateful for you being here, and on behalf of my colleagues and counsel and the court staff, we thank you very much for having us here. We'll be in recess.